Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of the show where we host quick conversations on Iowa news of the week. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk with Des Moines Register reporter Tony Lays about his reporting this week on a scam involving drinkable sunscreen that was marketed and sold across Iowa. He'll also share details on the news that medical marijuana dispensaries were offered licenses to set up shop in five areas of the state. First, let's check in with IPR's State House correspondent Joyce Russell about what's been happening at the Iowa legislature this week. Hello, Joyce.
Hello, Emily.
So yesterday, Governor Reynolds signed two bills into law that deal with mental health. Tell us about these.
Well, mental health has really risen to the top of concerns for a lot of people in and out of state government. And one of these bills is a comprehensive look at mental health services in the state, the result of a lot of work by outside groups, police, healthcare people, and just trying to address the gaps, I guess you could say, in Iowa's mental health care system. Mental health is delivered regionally throughout the state. There are mental health regions. And this comprehensive bill that the governor signed will put new mandates on them on services that they have to offer. And a lot of this has to do with sort of short and medium range, sometimes long range services that will take the pressure off of emergency rooms and, frankly, jails where people with mental illness end up and there's no place to take them. And so it's a very comprehensive package of new services, beefing up old services. And there was a crowd of about 200 people at this bill signing, just an indication of the intense interest there is in mental health care and the big hope that people have in this bill, although everyone was very careful to say that this is a framework and that a lot of work needs to be done to carry out these plans.
Mm-hmm. So do you get the sense that this is what, you know, mental health care advocates have been pushing for? Is this enough?
Well, if all of this happened, it would certainly be a big step forward. I neglected to mention that the other bill that the governor signed is a bill about suicide awareness, and it creates a new mandate for schools to become more aware of the signs of suicide. There were people in the crowd yesterday that had suffered, you know, who's had lost family members from mental illness, and I think there was from suicides, and I think there was intense interest in that bill as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, for both of these bills, I'm wondering about funding because, you know, mental health is a fairly bipartisan issue. People on all sides agree that it's something to be worked on, but, you know, the main issue is usually, is there enough money for it? So for both these bills, did funding play into the bills at all?
Well, as I was explaining about the regional mental health regions of the state, the services are delivered through these regions, and that the services are funded by property taxes. And so there will be some pressure on that to pay for these services. Representative Utmeyer, the speaker, was asked about funding yesterday, and she said that those first dollars will come from the counties and from the regions. Then beyond that, there may be other ways that the state can help. You know, anytime the property taxes are brought up, that there's an intense interest in that, and that nobody likes to have their property taxes raised. So that is an important piece of this. And then the work group that came up with the recommendations that were approved in the bill yesterday, they're going to continue their work looking at a number of things, involuntary commitment of people with mental illness. They're going to be looking at, they refer to it as tertiary care hospitals. And what that means is hospital settings where they take care of the most difficult patients, dangerous patients, intransigent patients. So they're going to be studying that more and also studying funding. So they may be, who knows, they may be coming up with a new funding mechanism for these advancements.
There was another firing at the Iowa State House in response to a sexual harassment complaint. Last week, the governor fired the director of the Iowa Finance Authority, David Jamieson. And she said this week that you reported on this, that they were credible allegations. And she says, that's all I needed. What more do we know about this story?
Well, we don't know very much. And because, you know, sexual harassment complaints are confidential, although the governor has been coming in under some criticism, some wishing for more transparency in this. It happened very quickly. More than one employee of the agency came to the governor's office on Friday night, made the allegations. The governor brought her staff together, her chief legal advisor and her, you know, top people, chief of staff, talked about it Saturday morning. And then Mr. Jamieson was fired Saturday afternoon, so it was quite a summary judgment. And some people just wish they knew more about that. I don't know whether more information will be coming out. Mr. Jamieson and Governor Reynolds have been friends for a long time. They are former county treasurers, and in that sense, they were colleagues as former county treasurers. Mr. Jamieson was appointed by Governor Branstad while Kim Reynolds was Lieutenant Governor.
Mm-hmm. And as we've talked about on this show, and we've had her on to talk about this, the former Iowa Senate President Mary Kramer this year has given recommendations to the lawmakers at the Capitol to kind of better address complaints of sexual harassment. I mean, are we seeing Mary Kramer's recommendations in action here?
Well, they are carrying out her recommendations. They have hired a human resources person. They've undergone more training. And when the leadership change happened last week in the Iowa Senate, the new Senate president, Charles Schneider, said that was going to be his top priority to keep an eye on that and make sure that all of her recommendations are being implemented.
Mm-hmm. Last Friday on the show, we talked about the legislature proposing a cut of $11 million from the University of Iowa and Iowa State with just a few months left in the current fiscal year. What's the latest on these cuts?
Well, that was a package of $35 million in cuts. You're right, $11 million for University of Iowa and Iowa State University to bring this year's budget into balance. I think there was some hope that the governor would not sign this entire package, but she did on Thursday. You know, she does have line item veto authority, and so she could have singled out any one of those cuts, including the, she couldn't reduce it or increase it, but she could have just line item vetoed it. But she signed the whole package. I think some people had some hope that she might not, because her recommendation for cuts for the region's universities was about $5 million. So this goes, for the universities, it goes, you know, it doubles what she had wanted, but she did sign the entire package on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. And what else is being cut as part of that package?
Oh, it's, you always hear the top ones being mentioned are the universities and human services, courts and corrections. But really, that's just because those are the biggest budgets. You know, when you need to make a mid-year budget cut, you go for the biggest targets, and really the regents and education are the biggest target. Human service, one of the biggest targets. So, but there are cuts all across state government, and in many cases, it's just simply up to the agencies to find that savings.
All right, Joyce Russell, IPR's State House correspondent, thank you so much for joining me today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
And you can follow Joyce's reporting on Twitter at Russell_IPR. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. With me now is Des Moines Register health reporter Tony Lace, who's here to discuss some of the things he's reported on this week. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Emily. How are you doing?
Good, good. Thanks so much for joining me today.
You
so
bet.
You reported on the news this week that Iowa approved five marijuana dispensaries, the licensing for these dispensaries that we could see by the end of the year being set up in the state. Is that right?
That's the plan.
And you published an article with the headline, "Does that mean you can soon get legal pot?" Now, I'm assuming this isn't a simple yes or no question. What are the details here?
Well, anybody who thinks they're going to be able to get marijuana that they can smoke and get high off is going to be deeply disappointed. These stores are not going to sell smokable marijuana and they're only going to sell to people who have state cards saying that they have one of the conditions that qualifies you to purchase products developed under this program.
Mm-hmm. And remind us, what is legal in the state? What will they be offering at these dispensaries?
They're going to be offering oils, creams, gel caps with the oil in it. They're talking about making suppositories, and at this point, that's all they're planning to do. And it will have cannabidiol in it, and some of it will have a little bit of THC, which is the chemical that makes recreational users high. But it's going to be a pretty low amount, so you'd have to take a lot of these oils or these capsules to try to get high off it.
Mm-hmm. And what cities met those licensing requirements?
They gave out licenses in Windsor Heights, Council Bluffs, Davenport, Waterloo, and Sioux City.
Mm-hmm.
One of the surprises to me was that there wasn't one in Cedar Rapids, Iowa City corridor, which is obviously a big population center and tends to be pretty liberal politically, where you'd think there might be more interest in this. But they decided for geographical reasons to spread it out as much as they could across the state.
Mm-hmm. So patients that, you know, live in wherever in the state have kind of a max of what, 1 to 3 hours drive to get the medicine?
Yeah, I would, one, probably closer to 2 hours, but yeah.
Okay. Yep. And well, also a big chunk of southern and northern Iowa were kind of excluded from this list. You can see kind of a band across the state where these dispensaries may be up.
Sure, and that was mainly based on where the population centers are. There wasn't anybody who applied for one in, say, Ottumwa or Mason City, and I think that's just because there wasn't a big enough population center for them to think that they could make a go of it.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, about the demand for this, because you reported that fewer than 400 of our 3 million residents in the state now have a permit to access this type of medical marijuana. That's a really small amount.
It is, because there's no doubt that at least tens of thousands of Iowans could qualify if they wanted to. You have to apply, you have to get a doctor to sign or another healthcare practitioner to sign a form saying you have one of the qualifying conditions. And that's not, so far, always an easy thing to do. And right now, you can't use those cards to buy anything in Iowa. So it'll be interesting once these stores actually get open if there will be more interest in it.
Mm-hmm.
But if there were only 400 people across 5 dispensaries, you can see that there's not going to be a big moneymaker here. And the main company, which has 2 of the dispensaries and is the only licensed production facility, is owned by MedFarm here in Des Moines. They're spending over $10 million to set up a production facility. If they don't get more customers than that, it'll be hard for them to make a go of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm curious because I wonder if, you know, there's any lessons to learn from Minnesota's medical marijuana, setup system where, you know, people from Minnesota reported that their medical marijuana program was kind of crippled at first because it was so restrictive that dispensaries, you know, they all registered a combined loss of $11 million in the first 2 years.
Mm-hmm. There is a push already for the legislature to expand the law that they just passed last spring to allow more THC and to allow doctors to essentially say whatever condition they think could be helped by this, they would sign that they believe their patient could be helped by medical marijuana and leave it up to the doctors to decide. I don't know if that's going to pass this spring, if the legislature is going to be very excited about expanding a program before it even gets up and running. But there is pressure from the folks involved in this to do that for that very reason.
Well, and of the medical marijuana substances that would have more THC, which currently isn't allowed in Iowa, you know, what would that help?
The proponents say that the main group of folks who that would help are people with chronic pain, that it's the THC that really helps them, and that what they're going to be selling under the current law really would not be of much benefit to them, which makes you wonder how many of them would just buy marijuana on the black market, and there obviously are people doing that now. It both has higher THC and probably will be cheaper, and also you can buy it in almost any town in Iowa. you wouldn't have to drive 2 hours to get it. So that is the reality of where we're at.
Mm-hmm. I want to have you respond to someone commenting on your article. This is kind of interesting. Lauren wrote that, quote, you know, maybe only have 300 applications because doctors such as the ones at the Iowa Clinic have decided not to allow their patients access to the medical marijuana. Lauren says, I filled out the paperwork since I have Crohn's disease, asking my doctor of 13 years that I see yearly to sign it for me. And he said that the doctors have decided not to allow this in their practice. Is this what you're hearing from patients and doctors that you speak to, that doctors are just kind of avoiding this for now and seeing how things shake out in Iowa?
I don't know if the Iowa Clinic has put that down as a policy. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I do know that some doctors are saying they're hesitant. They haven't decided what to do because it puts them in an unusual position. They're not prescribing these drugs. They're not prescribing a set dose and a set amount for a set condition. They're just being asked to sign a paper saying my patient has one of the qualifying conditions. So the truth is there isn't as much scientific research about medical marijuana as there is for a lot of other medications. That doesn't mean it doesn't work, but doctors don't have a lot of studies to prove that it does. I mean, critics will counter that, yeah, that's because the government has pretty much barred research into its use, and that's a fair point, too. But it does put the doctors into a little bit of an awkward spot. I'm not sure that most of them have decided they're not going to do it. What I'm hearing is a lot of them are hesitant and are trying to figure out what to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, remind us, what are we going to be seeing in the coming years, these dispensaries get set up and ready to open?
Well, they're going to be relatively small retail shops. The company that's going to run the one in Windsor Heights, which is Des Moines suburb, described to me as looking a little bit like a combination clinic pharmacy, that you'll come, there will be quite a bit of security. You'll come in the front door, and you'll have to show your state cannabis card to even get in. And that then once the security guard lets you in, you'll be brought into the back, and you'll meet with the staff of the store about what your needs are and what you want to buy, and they'll show you what your options are. Mm-hmm. It'll be pretty low-key. I don't expect it to be like Colorado-style, wide-open, Wild West kind of thing.
Before I let you go, let's touch on a bit of weird news that you reported on this week. You reported about a drink that, among other, you know, health benefits that it claimed, it said it's a kind of a drinkable sunscreen that it could protect the drinker from the sun's rays. Tell me a little bit about this scam. What happened here?
Well, the Attorney General's office looked into this, and it was hard for the media to pass up a story that included the phrase drinkable sunscreen. It was a company that was saying it used a special electrical contraption that some Iowa farmer invented to turn water into a magical elixir that if you drank a little bit of it, it would prevent you from getting sunburn. It also, they sold versions of it that would also prevent mosquito bites and treat your autism. And the ingredient list was water, period. And they were selling it for $30 for 3 ounces. Turns out this was not a great idea.
Tony Lace, health reporter at the Des Moines Register. You can follow his reporting on Twitter at Tony Leys. Tony, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. The Cambridge Analytica Facebook scandal has millions questioning the safety of their data online. And this news is making an Iowa State University lecture all the more timely. Next Wednesday, Assistant Professor of Computer Science Eric William Davis will host a talk called Is Your Data Safe? Corruption, Money Laundering, and the Malicious Side of Data. That'll be at 8 p.m. in the ISU Memorial Union. And Eric joins me now. Hi, Eric.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. So, you know, what we've been hearing with the recent Facebook story is that when we agree to terms and services on, you know, free social media sites, our data is being collected and sold to companies. And I think it's pretty well understood at this point that these companies want to target ads and sell products to us. But are there more insidious ways our data is being used?
So I think that the whole concept of data is a double-edged sword, right? So it enables a lot of excellent analytics that can make our lives better, and enables things like precision medicine, where we get individualized recommendations for patients. It lets us do some of the work we're doing with the World Bank and the United Nations to hunt down money laundering, corruption, and beneficial ownership. But the flip side is if we can do all these great predictions with data for good, people can, of course, use it for evil and you know, also just in different kinds of applications that could impact our privacy, impact our well-being. So it is important to kind of think about who we're exposing our data to, but at the same point in the modern world with Gmail and all these other services that are harvesting our data, individuals, I think, have made the decision to trade some of their privacy for some of these benefits.
Mm-hmm. So you're going to be talking, next Wednesday about several examples of data collection being manipulated by companies. And you say that this is done by companies to avoid regulatory oversight, sanctions, or investigation. Tell me a little bit more about what you mean by that.
So what we're looking at specifically in this work is people who use the normal data ingestion mechanisms for selection at, say, the United Nations or the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund or even the U.S. Public Procurement System, SAMS, in order to change the profile of their company, say, avoid previous sanction, appear as a different company, or represent that they have certain skills they don't actually have. And by doing this, they can often evade previous sanctions and debarment. They can evade punishment for things that they've done and end up taking money from the public and abusing the public trust over and over again. Now, we're not just going to talk about cases in the financial area, although that's a big area of concern and obviously one that we're trying very hard to make some inroads on. But I'll also be talking about some work we've done on FDA data sets where we were able to show that companies have misrepresented nutritional content of food that they were publishing as the official manufacturer's nutritional representation. What we're finding is that increasingly companies are finding ways to fudge data, submit bad data, or realizing there simply aren't any checks to tell whether the data is right or not. When you pick up a protein bar from your store, for instance, and you read the ingredients and the calories, you put a lot of trust in the company that they've submitted the correct information and trust in federal regulatory bodies that they're checking that information. But, of course, no one's going to replicate all of these experiments. We've seen a lot of this recently in publications that even in science, we don't see a lot of replication of results. So we're trying to find other ways to test the data for sanity. We can't necessarily say data is trustworthy, but oftentimes we can say that it is untrustworthy and that it should not be used.
All right. Well, that's all we have time for. You can find out more next Wednesday, April 4th. That'll be at 8 p.m. in the ISU Memorial Union in Ames. Eric William Davis, he's an assistant professor of computer science at ISU. He will be giving that talk titled, Is Your Data Safe? Corruption, Money Laundering, and the Malicious Side of Data. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you very much.
All right, stay with us. Coming up in the second half hour, we'll hear about how Iowa judges are interpreting Iowa's new Stand Your Ground law in courts. Also, I'll talk with an astrophysicist about an uncontrolled Chinese space station expected to crash into our atmosphere over the weekend. This is River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Good afternoon. You're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's a NewsBuzz edition of the show where we host quick conversations on Iowa news of the week and talk with Iowans who have insight on major events. One such event coming up involves a Chinese space station that will be crashing into Earth's atmosphere over the weekend. And one of the possible debris paths includes Iowa. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a University of Iowa astrophysicist about that news. Right now, I'm here with IPR reporter Katarina Sestarek to discuss her ongoing reporting on how Iowa's fairly new standard ground law is being interpreted by Iowa courts. Hi, Katarina.
Hi, Emily.
So as a reminder, the standard ground law says that law-abiding people don't have to retreat before using deadly force if they believe they're in danger, even if they're wrong in estimating the danger they face, right?
Correct.
Okay, so help us remember the facts of this case.
So this case was the first test of Iowa's Stand Your Ground law. Lamar Wilson was accused of shooting three people on the Iowa City Pedestrian Mall. That's in downtown Iowa City. This was last summer in August when the pedestrian mall was very crowded with students coming back to college, and three people were shot. One of them eventually died. And so Lamar Wilson, when he was going through the court process, claimed that he was acting in self-defense, and he claimed protection under the, at the time, brand new Stand Your Ground law that was passed by the Iowa legislature. And so at that point, the judge in his case decided you need to go through a full trial, and after the jury decides a verdict, then I will decide whether you can basically go free because you were justified in using deadly force. So this week, the judge decided that he is not immune from criminal charges. And so that's kind of where the case stands right now.
So what was the judge's reasoning here? Why didn't Stand Your Ground apply in this case, according to this Johnson County judge?
So in his ruling, this is Judge Paul Miller. He writes that the evidence shows that Wilson indiscriminately discharged a dangerous weapon five times into a crowd. He says that Wilson struck three unarmed individuals, including Kalik Jones, who was shot in the back, and he subsequently died from his wounds. Miller also writes that Lamar Wilson never testified that anyone pointed a firearm at him before he fired. And he also said that it was clear there was a history of some ill will and violence between these two groups, one from Iowa City and one from Cedar Rapids.
Now, that's interesting because I wonder if there was a history of ill will, wouldn't Wilson be expecting violence? He could be estimating danger, in effect, right?
Well, right. And that's what he argued. But the judge ultimately decided that there was that the evidence did not show that he was justified in using this force. And now in his ruling, the judge also wrote that he thinks part of the Stand Your Ground law is too vague to be enforced. And so he took issue with this part where it says that if a person is found to be justified in using deadly force, that they should be immune from criminal or civil liability. And so the judge kind of argues he doesn't really know what that means. And so some other law professors say that it is pretty vague and it doesn't provide instructions to judges on what sort of process they're supposed to use while these people who are claiming this are moving through the legal system. So the judge thinks that it would be applied in an arbitrary or discriminatory fashion. Basically, it just wouldn't be applied fairly to people across the state. And so he thinks that that part of the law just can't be enforced because it's too vague.
Is the defense settling for this? What? How are they reacting to this ruling?
So the defense is asking for a new trial. One of the reasons is because they say that the jury was chosen in a biased manner. And they also say that Wilson was entitled to a hearing before the trial to decide whether he was immune under the Stand Your Ground law rather than deciding after the trial, which is what this judge did. And then they're also asking the judge to reconsider his ruling on the immunity issue.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mention, you know, trying to decide whether Stand Your Ground applies before the trial or after, because we actually had another case in Iowa where Stand Your Ground was brought into the fray and it didn't go to trial.
Right. There was a case in Montgomery County. Apparently a man there was attacked and he fired his gun. And in that case, he also claimed claimed immunity under the Stand Your Ground law. And that judge gave him a pretrial hearing and then let him go, dismissed charges against him. So it's actually already been applied unequally in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. So what are your questions moving forward as you continue to look at this case and other, you know, cases involving Stand Your Ground in the state?
Well, I guess at this point, it'll just seems like it's going to work its way through the court system. A law professor told me that he believes the Iowa Supreme Court will ultimately have to decide, you know, maybe they will clarify a procedure for the courts to use in these cases, or even maybe lawmakers could take it back up and clarify more what they meant by what they want the procedure to be in the law. So it'll just be some waiting until one of those things happens.
All right. Katarina Sestark, IPR reporter. You can follow her reporting on Twitter at Katarina SOS. Katarina, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Emily.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to River to River on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. We've been talking about the pedestrian mall shooting case in last August, where one of the defendants pushed for immunity under Iowa's new Stand Your Ground law. And here with me now to explore the case further is a criminal defense attorney in Dubuque, Stephen Drahozal. Stephen, thanks for joining me today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like this judge is taking issue with kind of one section of the Stand Your Ground law, the part that fails to provide instructions to judges on how to use the law in court proceedings. So I guess, you know, my first question is, to what degree is it the legislature's duty to provide instructions to the court? And then to what degree is it the court's responsibility to interpret the law as they see fit?
Well, it's the when the legislature drafts the law, they put the obviously the language of the statute in there. It has to be clear enough so that a court can interpret it, and I think that's what Judge Miller was talking about in his ruling when he said that it was unconstitutionally vague. If you have a statute that is written in such a way that the court cannot apply the statute, or it is what the law says is overly inclusive and overly broad. Well, overly broad is a little bit different than vague, but one of the things that may be in the law that makes it vague is an overly broad statute so that the court is not able to apply it in a circumstance. So the legislature has to draft a law in such a way that it is specific enough for the court to interpret it. Now, as Judge Miller talked about in his ruling, the court tries to uphold the constitutionality of the portions of the statute that it can, so the court also has a duty to apply the statute in a way that makes sense. But it appears in that Judge Miller, in reading that section of the law, felt that he was unable to do that because the law was too vague.
Mm-hmm. Katarina brought up a case from Red Oak where a man was charged with voluntary manslaughter this February, and Stand Your Ground was invoked. And in fact, the case didn't go to trial because the judge ruled that this is a case where Stand Your Ground, you know, is applied. And, you know, of course, different judges will interpret laws differently. But what do you see accounting for the main difference between these two cases?
I think the main difference between the two cases are the fact patterns of the case. The Red Oak case, the Staley case, was one where it was a case that I think a lot of people would think is fairly typical for the use of what most people call the Stand Your Ground law. My understanding of the facts in that case is that the defendant, Mr. Staley, was walking through an alley, and then two men with hoodies and a bandana and bandanas across their face ambushed him. The case in the Wilson case, or the facts in the Wilson case, as I read Judge Miller's opinion, are a lot more convoluted. We're not talking about a situation that is completely, at least according to Judge Miller's decision, unexpected. There's a history of violence between some groups of people going back and forth. And I think that that's the main difference there. When you look at the Staley case, it's what a lot of people think of. Somebody's walking along, minding their own business, was suddenly surprised by an attack out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm. In the future, how will we see judges interpreting Iowa's Stand Your Ground law? Will we continue to see judges kind of saying, you know, we don't have a lot of instructions on how to use this law in court proceedings? How could that concern be remedied?
Well, I think the only way that it's going to be remedied is through litigation. As one reads through the new law, there are several points that I see where issues could be raised from a defense standpoint, and that the prosecution in a criminal case would argue. Iowa has a very long history of justification or self-defense. The two terms, most people refer to it as self-defense, but legally we call it justification. There's been a long history of defining what justification is through interpreting our statutes and through court cases. This law being relatively new and making some very large changes to the law makes it a little bit difficult because it throws out a lot of court decisions before. So I expect that it will not be uncommon that we're going to start seeing judges in the district courts as defense attorneys raise issues and as prosecutors raise issues on this coming down with different rulings. It's going to take these cases eventually going up to the Iowa Supreme Court to settle what some of the terms in the law mean and how the law should be applied.
As a criminal defense attorney, what are the main questions you have at this point about Stand Your Ground?
The main questions that I have, one would be, which I already brought up, about a forcible felony. Another one that I think is going to come up is issues about, because the law specifically states that if you are estimating the danger against you and you are using reasonable force or deadly force, the law now says that you can be wrong as long as that belief is reasonable. So that's going to be a big fighting issue that I see. Defense attorneys are obviously going to say that the defendant, the person accused of the crime, felt that the danger, that their belief was reasonable, and that there's going to be a lot of it, cases going to the jury where it's going to be up to the jury to decide, well, is that a reasonable belief? Is that not a reasonable? There are some exceptions to this. People are going to make mistakes and use reasonable force to defend themselves, defend someone else, defend property, and they're going to be making mistakes about when they can actually use this, and they may fall into one of the exceptions and not even realize that they're falling into the exceptions. Just reading through the law, something that I can see coming up, kidnapping is a forcible felony. You're allowed to use reasonable force to stop that, or if you reasonably believe that a forcible felony is being committed. However, the law says that you can use deadly force, and it's presumed reasonable, if you see someone removing or attempting to remove a person from a home, a business, or an occupied vehicle. Then you go into the law and it says, however, if the person against whom the force is used, in other words, the person removing that person, is actually removing a child or a grandchild or someone over whom they have legal custody, for example, a guardian and the warden a guardianship, then you cannot use the Stand Your Ground law. So somebody may say, okay, I reasonably believed that a kidnapping was taking place, but it was somebody just removing their own child over whom they had custody. And that could be an issue that would need to be litigated with defense attorneys, negotiations with prosecutors. So those are some things that I see coming up in the future.
All right. Stephen Drahuzal, criminal defense attorney in Dubuque. Stephen, thanks for talking with me.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. A Chinese space station roughly the size of a school bus will crash into Earth's atmosphere sometime between tomorrow morning and the afternoon of April 1st. One of the debris paths includes Iowa, though the crash path is still highly uncertain. Here with me now to discuss the threat as well as talk about how NASA's preparing for this reentry is Allison Janes. She's an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. Allison, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So, you know, a lot of the space station will burn up in the atmosphere. And like we said, the crash path is still kind of highly uncertain. Is this kind of just a cool story or is this something we need to be really worried about?
Absolutely. It's nothing that we need to be worried about. This kind of thing happens pretty regularly, actually. Anything that we launch into near Earth space generally comes back down and burns up into our atmosphere. We're left with every bit of that material being obliterated, except for maybe a few pieces the size of an orange or so. However, the probability of any person walking around getting hit by that is very, very small, about one in a trillion or even smaller. And so there's really nothing that we should be concerned about.
Okay. Is there going to be anything to look for? Will we be able to see this in the night sky?
I hope so. And actually, we might even be able to see it in the day sky as well during when the sun's up. It's highly, like you said, uncertain when and where it will come down. I think the where is even more uncertain than the when. And actually, those predictions have changed in the last day, and we're possibly looking at sometime later on the 1st rather than thinking about any time on Saturday at this point.
Okay. So what do we know about this space station?
Well, it was launched in 2011, and at some point in early 2016, the Chinese released a statement saying that they had lost control of that spacecraft. And as far as we know, they had not gained control since that time. And so it is truly on an uncontrolled reentry path at this point.
And when you say uncontrolled, I wonder what that means, because I'm assuming that with a telescope, you could still see it in the night sky and kind of see its path a little bit? Or
sure. If you have a telescope that can track fast enough, you're still able to see it. However, we're not able to control where and when it comes into the atmosphere, which is what I'm referring to as an uncontrolled reentry. So usually when we want these things to come back in and burn up, in case there's any little pieces left over that don't completely burn up, we want them to land in the ocean. There's a vast expanse of water covering most of the planet, and so if we can make sure that they reenter at that point, then there's no possibility of any of those pieces landing in human active areas.
Mm-hmm. And what control do we, and by we, I guess I mean maybe NASA, what control do we have about where they fall?
So usually we can sort of fly them and deorbit in a very specific point if we can talk to the spacecraft. In this case, with the Tiangong, they don't have any communications access. So they haven't been able to talk to it, and it has just since 2016 been slowly deorbiting depending on the drag it experiences in the Earth's upper atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. Now, people listening may remember the movie Gravity, and we talk about space debris frequently. Kind of worry about space debris causing mayhem with our satellites, with the International Space Station. For the past few years, is that something that we've needed to worry about with this out-of-control space station?
Well, this is a nice big piece of material out there, and we can track it very easily. And for the most part in space, we can predict where it's going to be at any given time. The uncertainty comes in when it gets into the lower parts of our atmosphere and where exactly it'll start to burn up and where exactly it will be when it ends up in our lower atmosphere is the part that we're not sure about. But we can track it out in space, and we can steer things such as the International Space Station and other commercial assets around our space debris pretty easily, as long as we know where it is.
Now, we talked about the odds of being hit by falling debris being really, really low. But as I was reading about this story, I heard that there is kind of something to be concerned about, maybe a highly toxic substance called hydrazine. What do we know about that?
That's right. So we're not entirely sure in this case whether any of that hydrazine or a component found in the rocket fuel used to propel the spacecraft will survive and make it back down through the atmosphere and be intact and toxic when a piece that may survive lands on the ground. So NASA's definitely cautioning everyone, if they do find a piece, to let the authorities know and to not go up and touch it. Being in the vicinity isn't necessarily dangerous, but going up and handling it with your bare hands might be.
Now, again, that's such a low chance, but how would you know if you see something on the ground, whether it came from a space station? That would be one of my last thoughts, if I saw a piece of metal on the ground or whatever, that it came from space. How would you know?
That's a good question, and I really do hope that this is one of the events where social media is going to be really important, where people are going to be watching for this reentry and looking for where that track comes into the atmosphere. And then once we know the path of that reentry burn, we will be able to go out and look for these pieces. Obviously, if there's a piece of metal that looks like it's been recently burned on the ground, then that might be a indication that you're seeing a piece of that space debris. But again, it's very, very unlikely that many of these chunks will survive.
Now, I would love to see the Chinese space station coming into Earth's atmosphere and burning up. And it sounds like you're going to be looking for it, too. What is the best way to make sure you see this? What are you going to be looking for?
That's a good question. There's not a whole lot of official information out there at this point. What I've been doing is tracking it using a visualization found on the Aerospace Corporation's website. They have a real-time graphic that's updated every few minutes, giving you the altitude and the latitude and longitude, and even a little map showing the current location of the Tiangong. And so once you see that altitude start to drop and drop, you could also check to see if the track of the spacecraft is coming over the region where you live.
Okay. We've been talking about a Chinese space station that's roughly the size of a school bus. It will be crashing into Earth's atmosphere sometime between tomorrow morning and possibly the evening of April 1st. Allison Jane's an astrophysicist at the University of Iowa. Thanks so much for joining me today and bringing some insight to this story.
Sure. Thank you.
And to close out today's show, Iowa Public Radio music host Tony Daner is here with a fresh recommendation for us to jam into the weekend with. Tony, what track do you have for us this week?
Hey, Emily. This week, it comes from an Iowa band, the band called Middle Western, that's performed live on IPR a couple of times, and you can find their performances at our website. This is kind of an all-star band, and it's led by William Elliott Whitmore and David Zolo, two pretty well-known guys around here. And this debut album from Middle Western, finally here, it's called When Your Demons Are Underground and You've Got to Dig Them Up. And the song we're going to hear is called Help Me.
All right, let's take a listen. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
This is Help Me by Middle Western from the album When Your Demons Are Underground and You've Got to Dig Them Up. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury.